Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from just outside of New York City and from an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
It's one of those days in this sport, Andrew, where you're at the bottom of a mountain and you hear rumbling. And it's like in the distance. And the next thing, there's an avalanche of news about to smash you in your brain tank. And that's what happened today. Just unbelievable. And I could think of no other way to discuss this and go through everything without using serious ITN News at 10 news music. See what I mean? How intense and terrifying is that?
That just screams of integrity and important.
Right.
It's so very British.
It really is. So my dad has a problem. He watches the 6 o'clock news on Radio Telefáisiúin, RTE. He watches the 9 o'clock news, and he always loved the 10 o'clock news on the British channels. So that's what he did. So I used to get a barrage of news into my brain. And with every bong, there would be some information. Now, I will say it was much graver than the bongs we're about to have tonight. But the first bong, bong, attacks on Dubrovnik continue as Yugoslavia descends into war. Bong. IRA volunteer caught with 700 pounds of Semtex in Nottingham. Bong. Princess Diana goes on holiday. What does this mean for the royals? Bong. That kind of thing. But we're going to do it by the bongs.
It's basically not like the bongs here on our local news, which is like, well, there was plenty of monkeying around at the zoo today.
No, these were much graver, much more serious. Yeah. Bongs.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, I've kind of combined them, JJ.
Oh, you
like
have?
The seriousness of the bongs with the silliness of our local news and its punnery. So should we get into it? Because we have several stories here on the news at 10 tonight. That is what it is, right? The news at 10?
The news at 10. Said? And it used to be read by a very grave looking man called Trevor MacDonald. So tonight, Andrew, you are Trevor MacDonald.
Okay. So here is our, I guess we've done our intro, and now, JJ, our top story tonight, it's more money, more problems for Manchester City as the Premier League levies over 100 financial charges against them. Seriousness, gravity. JJ, according to the Premier League, City breached rules relating to UEFA regulations, which include FFP from 2013 to 2018, as well as the English top flight's profitability and sustainability rules from 2015 to 2018. There have also been further breaches which concern handing over full details regarding manager remuneration as well as player remuneration in the 2010 to 2016 period. JJ, sometimes we talk about The Office on this program. You yes. a little bit more so the British one, me the American one. There's a scene from The American Office where Oscar is trying to explain to Michael what a surplus means. And he can never seem to get to a simple enough explanation for Michael until finally Michael says, explain it to me like I was five.
Right.
And I think that's where most of us fall with this sort of financial fair play and just being in the weeds of money and illegal
right.
sponsorships. I need this explained to me like I was a five-year-old boy.
Well, first of all, let's just talk about what came down. Released silently on their website today, or not so silently, the Premier League's four-year investigation into Manchester City revealed the charges it was taking against City, which were laid out per Premier League rule. So you had rule whatever, whatever, very kind of, what would you call it, legalese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was listening to BBC Radio 5 Live, and football financial expert Kieran Maguire was on, and he did the job of breaking it down into Labradorian terms for thickies like me and you and our listeners.
We'll see if he got to the five-year-old level.
Right. Okay. So Kieran says that basically we can lump the charges into two categories. So the first charges together are that Man City have artificially inflated the money coming into the club through sponsorship revenues, etc., when it's really come from the owner, just by a different name. Money coming in from the sponsorship revenues, etc., would not be it wouldn't concern itself with FFP. However, money coming from the owner would be problematic in terms of FFP. Charge two. City artificially deflated the costs of running the club. So for one example is the example that was floating around for years about, like, that's another thing. A lot of this stuff, I feel like we knew and we've been told, but we ignored it. It's been burning away for a while, this fire. But basically the Roberto Mancini incident situation where he was getting paid X amount of money by Manchester City. Well, hang on, here's another company that's paying him Y alongside that. Uh-huh. So that would inflate the cost that would be put down on the books of running the club would just be his Manchester City pay and not this shell company that's paying him more money.
The Those remunerations, if you will.
The remunerations, correct. Mm. So when I saw this today, my first reaction was wow, the detail the Premier League have gone into, how City were kind of caught on the back foot by it. Ferran Soriano, the CEO, was on the phone with the Premier League when all this was leaking. So it took City 2 hours to release their statement, which basically says, hey, yeah, we're going to cooperate with everything. And we're a bit surprised at the breadth of these charges because we've given you so much information already, which is the Premier League basically says that they have not done that. And they have not engaged with the investigation at all. So part of me was like, Tariq Panja has been like writing this one article once a month since 2018 about this investigation. Miguel Delaney has been writing once a month or maybe twice a month in his case about Man City and this investigation. And numerous people who are involved in the financials of football have been saying things about City. And also, I mean, don't urinate on our shoulders and tell us it's raining. Manchester City suddenly atop the Forbes revenue charts ahead of Liverpool and Manchester United and Real Madrid. Just stop. Okay.
Yeah.
Nonsense. Something was afoot. And now I guess the one thing is now the Premier League appear to be in the midst of pushing back. A couple of notes. So City have already been banned from the Champions League for 2 years, but that was overturned by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which basically said there was a statute of limitations on City.
So I have that here.
Yeah. So basically City there was wrongdoing, but because of the statute of limitations meant that, oh, well, these no prosecutions can be really taken against City. No indictments handed down to you.
Right, they kind of got off on a technicality.
They got off on a technicality. But here in this investigation, that's not the case. Right. There is no
statute of limitation here.
There is no statute of limitations. There will also be no court of arbitration for sport to go running to. So this is a very interesting juncture that we've hit today.
Yeah. Kaveh Solakol from Sky Sports.
He's great.
He said it like this. He said, the Premier League's financial fair play rules are designed to ensure clubs pretty much spend what they earn. You can get around that potentially by inflating how much you're earning or hiding how much you're spending. According to the Premier League, Man City allegedly broke the rules over 9 seasons. They allegedly didn't provide accurate financial information. It's also alleged, like you said, they had a secret contract with one of their managers, Mancini, allegedly. I mean, I know it's not fair to do this, but the cliche of where there's smoke, there's fire. I mean, this has been smoldering for a generation. And you wonder now if this is finally the fire starting to break out. I mean, what you said is what would worry me if I were Manchester City, the idea of the statute of limitations helping them the last time around and that not existing now. Let's see. This was from Sports Illustrated. This was from their article back in 2020 after the Court of Arbitration for Sport downgraded Manchester City's punishment. And they're discussing an element of the punishment that involves City disguising equity funding as sponsorship contributions. And they say on the funding from Abu Dhabi communications firm that sponsors City, CAS, the Court of Arbitration for Sport, said in the full verdict that the, quote, charges with respect to equity funding being disguised as sponsorship contributions from Etzalat are time barred. CAS said the alleged breaches fell outside their statute of limitations because the payments were received in June 2012 and January 2013. The club was, quote, well aware that the payments were made as equity funding, not as payments for the sponsor on account of genuine sponsorship liabilities. So it sounds like City, from this investigation, knew what they were doing, did it anyway, but managed to get off, like we said, on a bit of a technicality.
Yes.
So, by the way, my favorite, going back and reading some of the statements from that, when the Court of Arbitration for Sport overturned UEFA's ruling, my favorite line was when they said, CAS said City's conduct should be, quote, strongly condemned, and it hopes the large fine would be sufficiently strong deterrent to other clubs who have to comply with financial fair play rules to enter the Champions League and Europa League. Yeah, the 10 million, that's what it was. A 10 million euro fine for Manchester City's ownership. And they had, and the CAS had the nerve to refer to that as a strong deterrent to other clubs. What? How could they have thought that with a straight face?
If you were to go to Khaldun Mubarak's Mani residences and go into his Mani sofas, you'd find that 10 million down the back of his sofas. Like,
I do wish there was a way to, is there some kind of like Mubarak to Devani conversion chart? Like, I want to know what 10 million to him is to you or to me.
Yeah, right.
$15?
Yeah.
Maybe 100? I don't know.
Maybe. And we're pushing it there.
No, definitely not, actually.
It's not, actually. No. Of course it's not. I mean, what are we on about? This is why we're
He's
bad.
He's a billionaire, a multi-billionaire.
We're bad at the financials.
Yeah.
So, yeah. A tweet I wanted to read to you, Andrew, because you're talking about the fire. And I suppose that's the next kind of question we have to ask, like, where is this going? Nick Harris, who is a great follow at Sporting Intel, he's big on this. He's big on drugs and sport, all this area. He's an excellent follow on Twitter. He quote tweets an account called at SLBSN and then names who he is. So he says, Stefan is a former financial advisor to Man City, a Man City fan, a former banker, current lawyer, CEO and general counsel to a PLC dealing with allegations of historic accounting issues, also well across FFP issues. So this is an interesting view. And this is SLBSN's tweet. Alarmist or not, the sheer extent of the Premier League charges are at a level that, if found proven, must lead to relegation.
So, first off, wow, to even think of that.
Yeah.
Secondly, like, look, we know that these top European leagues are not necessarily opposed to taking that kind of action for a serious matter. Look what we saw with Juventus. But I just, this is one of those situations where I've just become somewhat, I don't know, the idea of financial penalties not being taken seriously, I feel like has been normalized.
Yes.
Where we just, we are of the expectation now that no one really wants to get serious about these problems. Maybe, I don't know, because they want these clubs to be spending in this way because it's more interesting. It brings in TV revenue. I don't know. You can come up with your own motives for whatever it is, but I just, it's become hard for us as fans to believe that a club who's in financial penalty like this would be punished severely. We're used to it, you know, with what Juventus did, you know, the compromising referees and things like that. That goes right to the heart of the of sport. So I think that we can all kind of like wrap our minds around that sort of punishment. But with these financial punishments, because we don't understand the rules entirely, it's just hard for us to envision it. So it's one of those things where I can hear those tweets. I'm gonna have to see it to believe it. I feel like the precedent hasn't really been thrown down on one of these huge clubs in that sort of way. And so if this is the moment, then City would be setting the new precedent, because I feel like we haven't really seen it yet. I guess I'd have to go back, JJ, and look at what happened with Rangers.
Taxes. Well, I mean, Rangers were relegated.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Maybe this sort of thing has happened before in not quite a large scale, as large a scale as this. And I'm just not quite as up to date with what the information was on those things. But with a club like City and just how big they are and how important they seem to be right now on a European and global scale, I got to see it to believe it.
Yeah, and a lot of fans share your skepticism that anything will come out of this, that it'll, first of all, the belief is, have you know the Dutch story of the boy who saved Haaland by sticking his finger in the dam?
Yeah.
Well, think of the dam. Think of all the water as all the allegations and the weight of evidence against Manchester City. And then think about a hole. And then think of the little boy as Khaldun El-Mubarak. And then think about that hole being stuffed with lawyers and litigation and paper and obfuscation and delay. That's how I think City will approach this. Don't forget, we know from Der Spiegel's report on WikiLeaks that City said that they would basically, their tactic would be to tie everything up with lawyers. They'd pay 10 lawyers 10 million a year, or however many much it'd take, for the next decade. They didn't care about how much it would cost to stop this thing moving forward. And you'd fear that this independent panel that's coming now might be under the same pressure, might be under the same problems from City. There's another wrinkle to this. So the government in the United Kingdom wants to bring in an independent football regulator who would regulate a lot of the financial aspects and just the running of football. Like, how is it that the PIF of Saudi Arabia own Newcastle United?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, issues like that. And obviously the Premier League doesn't want that person there. Now, if they don't want that person there, they have to be able to prove that football can run football, which is a general feeling that it can't. What better way to prove that football can run football by properly finishing this investigation against Manchester City and taking out the sanctions? So if the Premier League are in a mindset like, we are trying to keep further regulation away from us, but this is the sacrificial lamb. And when I say sacrificial lamb, that's not wrong. What's sacrificial crocodile is better, because like City have, as I know, these are all allegations, but I mean, I'm fairly confident that they will be proven, or can be proven, put it that way. And so, you know, maybe the Premier League looks at this and thinks, for the greater goal and good of the game and keeping a regulator away from our affairs, let's hit City as hard as we can.
It'll be fascinating if that happens. It'll be fascinating, too, because I know a lot of this has been going around over the last 24 hours, of the comments Pep made back in 2022, where he said, if they have lied to me, I'll leave the next day.
I said to them, this is the quote, if you lie to me the day after, I am not here. I will be out and I will not be your friend anymore. I put my faith in you because I believe you 100% from day one. And I defend the club because of that.
the friendship part is the part that really stings.
Yeah.
that's the real deterrent.
Yeah. So that's where we are right now. And we're Guardiola to follow on that. I mean, that would be really, really significant. But I just see this thing. This isn't going away, but by the same token, this isn't going to be wrapped up quickly.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
So I feel this is certainly the first part of it. And it is a stunning day because of the sheer breadth of like the 100 charges and the scale of it. I mean, we have Lucas Leiva tweeting today, am I now a Premier League champion?
I don't think that will happen.
And honestly, to be perfectly honest with you, like if you look at, say, the example of 13-14, like I wouldn't want it. Okay, City, there may be very provable allegations of financial impropriety against Manchester City. There's also very provable allegations of Chris Stamboul, 3-3. There's also very provable evidence of Steven Gerrard falling over. You know, those to me, I get the unfairness of what City done here, but like retrospectively stripping titles doesn't do anything for football and doesn't do anything for like the future of the game. Like it seems there's no time machine remedy for this.
I agree. I think future punishment is far more effective than retroactive punishment.
Yeah.
That's just the way I see it. Maybe we can get some kind of open top bus to roll through the streets of Manchester with that United team that lost out to like Aguero in 2012.
She's a United supporter. She sent me a list of those who'd won the title if you were to vacate City's titles. It's just Liverpool or Manchester United.
Yeah.
Basically. One after the other. Man United, Liverpool, Man United, Liverpool, Man United, Liverpool.
Yeah. It's interesting though, JJ. I wonder if you found this. The way this story resonated with non-soccer fans.
Yes.
Like, I had a bunch of text messages. Like, it's weird because it's very, even for soccer fans, a story like this is so, it's complicated. It's money. I don't know always if that's, is that what fans like? But I was getting text messages today from friends of mine who are not soccer fans saying, I can't wait for your pod. I can't wait to hear you guys talk about this. I said, wait, talk about what? Like the game or like yeah. Jesse Marsh? What? Who? No, the City thing. So I don't know. For some reason, it has really struck a chord with people. Maybe just the glamour of that club. People who know next to nothing about the sport are just fascinated with the idea that they could be kicked out of the Premier League, which is a big deal.
Oh, and sure.
I guess I'm talking myself into it. Maybe I can see now why it would hit people.
Yeah, and don't forget how many listeners just like swarmed to our podcast during the Super League. I mean, it was on the Daily.
Well, that was the end of the sport as we knew it.
New York Times. I wonder, will it, if it makes the Daily tomorrow, that'd be interesting. I don't think it will.
No, I don't see that happening.
Because there's other more important things happening, I guess. But yeah, that's where we're at. And I will say as well, you know, because engaging, I've got to get out of these rival club supporters spaces. My head just pops up in the space and I'm listening to them. And they're like, they're group therapy sessions, really, you know. So I went into the City one today and a lot of the talk was, you know, well, we're the outsiders. This is just the establishment pushing against us. And it felt terribly sad. Now,
I don't blame fans in a situation like this.
It's not
they
blame.
Didn't ask for their club to do things the wrong way.
I know,
they want to win. They want to have good players. They want to see their owners invest in the team. They're not in these backroom accounting meetings.
They're not. I know they're not. But it's amazing how many pictures I saw of In Khaldun We Trust, you know, straight afterwards.
You're like, surprised?
No, it's a major part of like any sports washing enterprises that you align the fans with the owners in a very tight bond. And one defends the other. And it's like a mutually symbiotic relationship that's developed there. Like this guy who, you know, literally in his entire life has probably never been told anything. He's the one that gives the orders. But like there's some kinship between him and like Manchester City working class fans, probably just because of the trophies he's delivered to the club. And City naturally see themselves as kind of outsiders. I remember hearing John Bruin talk about this way before the money. you know, this is what it means to be City is a thing for them, you know, because they're so hapless. I mean, they were just a disaster zone from most of the 90s and the 1980s as well, if you want to add that in. Just bad and badly run. Mm-hmm. And they still see themselves in that mindset. So they see it as like an establishment attack. And we've heard it all before. Same rebaked allegations. And I'm like, yeah, we have heard it before. And there's another part of me, Andrew, who's like, were we surprised? Like, how else was this supposed to work? A massive nation state takes over Manchester City and they're told, hang on, you're only allowed to put X amount of money in. And the nation state is run by a royal family that gives the orders, is never taking orders. And what way are they going to react? Like, are we that naive, I suppose?
Totally agree. Agreed on all counts. All right, JJ.
Let's do another bong.
Up next. This coming Sunday, American football defenses will be trying to sack opposing quarterbacks. But on this day, American coach Jesse Marsh was getting the sack of a different kind.
Oh, that perfectly read.
It's so local news. I love it.
I love it. I love what you've done. This is great. And I do see a career in news reading for you.
I just love it. I hope they don't. I'm not making fun of them. It's one of my favorite things about the whole industry. So Jesse Marsh, JJ, we'll go through the standard questions that we have when a manager loses his job.
Yeah.
Your gut reaction to this, you at all surprised?
Not massively surprised. I suppose slightly surprised that after that, you know, move in the window for players that would fit his kind of narrow central style of play, that he would be gone basically the day after most of them made their debut. That to me, but okay, not hugely surprised. The game on Sunday, Andrew, was so alarming in the sense that they dominated the first half. They were way better than Forest in possession. They missed chances. Keylor Navas made some amazing saves for Nottingham Forest. By the way, that sentence, Keylor Navas made some amazing saves for Nottingham Forest.
Yeah.
What on earth? They fell behind then, and you expected a big second half onslaught, and it never came. I don't think Navas had a major save to make in the second half. And then you just felt, you kind of started to really worry for Marsh because he did his usual thing. I take responsibility. I think we played well, but I just need to turn playing well into results. And you're like, right. Jesse, we've heard this before. When's it going to happen? I consulted my huge Leeds United supporting friend who's followed them home, abroad, Europe, whatever. I asked him. He said it was inevitable. It wasn't a question of if, but when. Surprised it came today, but what's the sense in waiting? It was a poison chalice anyway after Bielsa, but even more so for an American with no Premier League experience. Nice guy, but out of his depth, and his ideas on football was never going to work at Leeds. And then he goes on to say, I don't know why boards and owners don't consult history. The most successful Leeds managers, Don Revie, he was a player turned manager. Howard Wilkinson, a Yorkshireman. David O'Leary, Leeds player turned manager. And he said, even Bielsa, who had no connection before his appointment, he had a great track record of going into places and transforming teams that weren't at the top. He then says, next appointment is crucial or we are going down. And that is the key sentence. And that's why Victor Orta and the board acted.
A couple things with that. First off, what was the term you used there? In over his depth?
Like out of his depth.
Yeah, that feels really harsh.
It did feel like it, though, didn't it, Andrew? I mean, like the stats are, let's look at the stats. This is the Premier League record. 32 games, 8 wins, 9 draws, 15 losses, 39 goals for, 53 conceded, 6 clean sheets, sacked with a 25% win percentage. Like there was times where you thought he's too green.
Yeah, 2 wins in their last 17, 0 wins in 3 months. I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised.
I think bad also for the guy.
Yeah, me too. I like him. I like Jesse Marsh. I do think he's a good manager. I would never sit here and say you'll never work in this town again. Like, it's not like that. I think also it didn't help him that like Everton pulled the trigger on Lampard, went out and got Dyche, and immediately beat Arsenal. That probably didn't help. Not only because it tightens the screws on Leeds with Everton picking up a big 3 points, but it also sets a little bit of an example of, like maybe maybe we don't want to wait till it's too late. Everton went and pulled the trigger here, maybe at the right time. Maybe we don't want to let this go much longer. So that probably didn't help either. Like you, a little bit surprised that they would spend that kind of money. Reuter, McKinney, who was the other one? Wober. All pretty significant moves for Leeds to make, and then you fire the manager just a day later. Little bit strange, but nothing that I don't think is like overcomable for them. Like, I think a new manager can come in, even if those weren't necessarily the players that he brought in. Those are all talented players that I think a new manager can find ways to work with. So even that doesn't entirely shock me. I don't like that it happened. We like Jesse Marsh. I kind of rooted for him. I wanted to see this work badly. But I can't sit here. It would be disingenuous for me to say I'm stunned. I don't know where this came from. I get it. I do get it. Especially in that we talk all the time, JJ, about like relegation, especially a club like that that just came out of this generation of wilderness. They got to do everything in their power to make sure they don't go back to that sort of time again. So I understand it.
No, that's the general feeling you get. The fear, the absolute fear of relegation. They want whatever new manager bounce they can harness to kickstart this thing. And now the question is it going to be Andoni Iraola from Rayo Vallecano? They say that there's no chance of a return of Bielsa. That's not going to happen. Yeah. Who else was I seeing? The West Brom manager who's working wonders. That was another name that came up.
Thought I saw Ange Postecoglou's name.
I saw that too. I wonder. I don't want to give guys credit for things. It's a money game. It's a managerial game. Ange, the guy who's fought all his career to get to the level he's at now, and the Premier League would be his next natural stop. But I kind of feel like mid-season with Celtic doing what they're doing, he's not going to want to do that.
Well, I think these jobs, I mean, it's a Premier League position. They don't come along very often. I know Celtic are a huge club. I understand that.
Yeah.
But if you get offered one of these,
no, I agree.
There's no guarantee. Yeah. Look, it would surprise me if he never got another chance, but you don't know. You don't know how these situations can play out.
Andrew, he fought hard enough to get to Celtic. You know, so absolutely. But I just don't feel that's going to happen right now.
Well, who's the betting favorite? Is it Carlos Corberan? Is he he's West Brom manager?
West Brom manager.
His name has probably been the one most prominently featured for this opening.
Yeah.
Because he's like a Bielsa disciple, right?
Yeah. I mean, who isn't, though, really? I mean, everyone that seems to enjoy like pressing or something like that appears to be some kind of disciple of Bielsa. West Brom currently in sixth in the championship table. I don't know. I don't know about that one. I can't see that one either. I think it could be our friend Iraola from Rayo Vallecano. I mean, that was the big name that's floating around at the moment. I'm not sure who he's a disciple of. Maybe he's a disciple of Pep Guardiola.
Now, the angle of this that I'm more intrigued by is not what happens with Leeds' next manager. It's what happens next with their former manager.
Yes.
Jesse. Boy, USMNT Twitter really, really took this one and ran with it today. As you would expect, there is I don't know that I can sit here and say there's a opening right now for the head coaching position of the US men's national team. There kind of is, sort of. This is a guy now with pretty good European experience, not all of it great in terms of results, but he's a pretty well-traveled, as far as American managers go in Europe, pretty accomplished one. Doesn't get much more accomplished from that standpoint. And so now with him being available, he vaults right near the top of the list. But I've seen a little bit of back and forth. There are some who I've seen basically saying, this is it. This is the guy we've been waiting for. And there are some saying, not so fast. The results of what he just did and these last couple jobs have to mean something. So let's pause and take a breath here before we just dive right in.
Yeah. I saw one of those things that comes up on Twitter where you've got two completely competing viewpoints. So Pablo Maurer of The Athletic, who's a pretty great writer on US soccer, says, crazy that Jesse Marsh's potential appointment to the US men's national team is almost assumed among so much of the US fan base. Lots of positives there, but I could easily be convinced that another candidate is a better fit. Here's to hoping the Federation considers all the options they have. And then right below that, Nico Kantar. If Jesse Marsh's sacking at Leeds doesn't end up in him getting the US men's national team higher, I will enter into a state of despair. So, I mean, that kind of sums it up. I did see, I mean, I would say it's 75%. When can we get Marsh in on USMNT Twitter? I had a thought. So I watched JJ Bull and I forget the McKenzie, is it, from TIFO Football. And they were just talking about Jesse Marsh's system and the way he sets up, because I was curious about the football that I watched on Sunday. And they talked about how narrow the football is, because he believes the goal is in the middle of the, you know, the goal is central. So let's keep the ball down the center, get it into our midfielders. If they lose it, then we can create moments to press and win the ball back. And then we're in on goal. That kind of system. And that the fullbacks in that system, Andrew, function to just get the ball into the midfielders again and start moving the ball in that central area. If you're Serginho Dest and Anthony Robinson, the incumbents of our fullback positions right now, that's not what you want to be doing at all. So that was the first thing I thought, was like, would that be like counter to what some of his players might want to play in terms of his system? Now, I'm not saying Jesse Marsh only has one system, but that was his preferred method at Leeds United. You know, I wouldn't like seeing that if I was Serginho Dest and Robinson, or maybe I would. Who knows? But
You're going to have a hard time if you're waiting for the manager that gets unanimous approval from every member of the U.S. soccer community. You're going to be waiting a long time. And, you know, Jesse Marsh has had some good results in Europe. He's had Champions League experience in Europe. So, look, if it winds up being him,
it's a good appointment.
Yeah, I think so, too. But I also would not fall into the Nico Kantor category of,
no,
if this doesn't happen, you will find me in a dark corner somewhere in a fetal position. Like I'm not quite at that point yet. Look, here's the thing that you're trying to sift through is, and this idea of does the American team's manager have to be American? Because if it does, then Marsh is probably near the top of a short list of candidates.
Right.
I do not subscribe to that theory. I know that's the way it's been, with exceptions here and there. Klinsmann, although he's almost pseudo-American, he's lived in the U.S. for so long. His son was raised here. So even him. But like, I don't subscribe to that. I don't think it needs to be the case. So, but if you limit yourself to that, then what are we looking at? We're looking at a list of Marsh. I would throw Jim Curtin into that list. I think that that's a good suggestion. Who am I not thinking? Brian Schmetzer, maybe?
Schmetzer, Bob Bradley.
I mean, you think they'd go back to Bradley? I don't know.
I don't think they, I'm not saying they would, but when we're talking about possible, like actual guys with the kind of resume, Peter Vermees.
What about like a David Wagner?
David Wagner too, but he would be a European hire, let's be honest. Like, really.
Yeah, but
I mean, he's an American citizen, but not American in the cultural sense, in the soccer cultural sense anyway. Here's another one. And this one popped into my head today as well. And I wonder if you agree with me on this, Andrew. You know the obvious hire in international football? How often the obvious hire doesn't work out well. You know, that's the guy. So I'm thinking of, okay, well, they worked out well for a while, but like Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane, seen as this dream team tandem for the Republic of Ireland, that did not end well. And only had one qualification.
In this case, Marsh being the Martin O'Neill in that analogy?
Yes. There was a Martin O'Neill, there was a clamor for him for about 15 years. Now, maybe he came too late as a manager and his ideas were just too set in stone for Ireland. Maybe he needed to be a manager earlier on. And in that sense, Jesse Marsh is better positioned. Who else am I thinking of? There's a couple of glaring ones. Kevin Keegan at England. Like for about 20 years, it was, can we get Kevin Keegan to England? He ends up resigning in a toilet in Wembley after a 1-0 defeat, saying, I can't take the team any further. I'm just not good enough. There are examples where the guy that everyone says is the perfect fit, he understands us, he's one of our own, and he's had success somewhere else. Now we've got him for the national team. Ipso facto, we're going to be great. That doesn't work out very well. Jesse Marsh is young. Jesse Marsh probably wants to get a job in Ligue 1 or in the Bundesliga and get back at it and prove himself again, day to day working with players. That is not the remit of the US manager's job. International football is a part-time job in terms of actual coaching.
Yeah.
It's
very high profile.
Yes.
It's glamorous, but you're right. Like, that was going to be my next question. It's one thing for us to want Jesse Marsh, but is this a job that he would want? I don't know.
I think things went so well at Salzburg. They did not go well at Leipzig. They did not go well at Leeds United. He'll want to get back on the horse and prove himself again. I really do feel that. And it'll be at club level.
And I think he'll get, you know, it's funny. Everything you read about this is that you kind of get the same sense of, we all felt like he had to go, but we all really liked him. I think that can get you another opportunity quicker than if he left on some kind of bad terms, if his personality clashed with players or with others within the club. I think the fact that he seems to be very well liked, he'll get another job. If he wants one, I think there will be one for him. I don't know that it's in the Premier League, but if he wants another job in Europe, in a top flight somewhere, I think that there will be one for him.
Yeah. I think the Premier League will probably not be an option for him for a little bit. But I think there'll be a job. There could be a job in Ligue 1 in France, like I said. I see it in the Bundesliga, maybe Serie A. I don't think he's done by any measure. I think there's a lot of people like what he can bring, but like, he just the wins, man. The wins, they did not come. There was not enough of them.
And so now Chris Armas takes the reins.
Unbelievable. Chris Armas has...
He's been there, a week? Now he's going to be managing Leeds back-to-back games against Manchester United, potentially?
Yeah, unbelievable. And him part of the recent Manchester United history, where he was number two to Ralph Rangnick, just keeps getting jobs. Chris Armas' magical mystery tour.
Amazing.
New York, Toronto, Manchester, Leeds. Where next?
Let's see. All right, JJ. Next at 10, Kane takes aim and causes Pep more pain.
You gone for the rhyme there.
I don't know if that's quite local newsy.
No.
But it is still one of our big stories to deal with tonight, news at 10. We'll start with the Kane side of this. I don't know what's left to say about him. I mean, like, I think he tweeted this too, something to the effect of, not bad for a one season wonder. I mean, this was the MO that it was. His story was just so unbelievable in the most literal sense of that word to people that they couldn't wrap their minds around the fact that it was happening. So the only thing you could say is that he's a one season wonder. What just happened isn't real. Guys like him, journeymen, loanees in the lower divisions of the English ranks, they don't suddenly become this. This has to be a fluke.
No.
But he's just done it over and over and over until we reach this point where he's now past Jimmy Greaves, for God's sake, at Tottenham. And he's got to go down as I would think the preeminent striker of this era in the Premier League.
He's unbelievable. Do you know who his first ever goal for Tottenham was against?
Shamrock Rovers
in the Europa League.
Yeah.
Back when there was a chance he might have declared for Ireland. I mean, at that point, we thought he's gettable. He's not going to be a starter at Tottenham. He might be at best a championship striker, and we'll get him in because his grandfather's from Ireland. But like, that aside, I think the great thing I can say about him in terms of his touch, his awareness, his link-up play, his finishing, he got better and better and better as he went along. And from what I've heard, I've never heard anyone say that, when he was at Millwall, he was actually really good. He just didn't get the breaks. We saw something in him. When he was at Norwich, he looked like he could score lots of goals. It was just, we could see it coming. Nobody said that. And it was a crisis, basically, of, wasn't it a crisis of personnel? That there was enough injuries up top. He started to get a couple of substitute appearances, and then the next thing, it's just taken off.
It's an amazing story. It was really Tim Sherwood who kind of propelled him to really give him a go and give him a run of matches. And in fact, JJ, that was when I went to White Hart Lane. It was during Sherwood's time, and I was at the Tottenham Fulham match when Kane scored. So wow. I actually saw him score, which was cool.
What's your favorite Kane goal of all of them? Not that you think it's the, just your favorite for whatever reason.
Sure. I would say a couple against Arsenal. Maybe his most famous one, when he kind of steals it on the edge of the box and then just from an impossible angle whips one in off the post, throws his mask off, goes crazy. That one is just, it's such a legendary Harry Kane goal. Also, but the problem with that one is Alexis Sanchez wound up equalizing a few minutes later and it ended 2-2. He had a header to beat Arsenal in the 86th minute where he's sort of fading away from goal, but somehow still gets enough power on it to send it back the other direction. It's an unbelievable goal. Again, it's not his most beautiful one, but maybe the goal that he scored that made me scream the loudest because it was just so unexpected. Last season against Manchester City, deep in stoppage time after City had tied the game, it was just, you felt you were just saying a prayer that City weren't going to go on and win it. And I think when I think about Kane's performances, that game against City last year, well, it might be the best game I've ever seen him play for Tottenham. I think he had two goals and the assist. He was just on another planet in that game. That's the thing about him is that, he had one against Leicester City. I'd want to go back and see it again, but there's one against Leicester that stands out to my mind. I think it might've been a game where he had four against them. He has scored every kind of goal. Yeah. He has scored goals in big moments against big teams. He's never been a problem guy or a big ego guy.
Yes,
sort of. But I want to say something about that, which I don't think I've ever said on this podcast, actually, about the flirtation with Manchester City.
It was more than a flirtation. They were making out.
Yeah, that's fair. They were making out. But you might remember, JJ, when we were talking about that during those podcasts, I don't know, if you went back and listened now, you might think, Andrew wasn't really that hard on Kane then. Like, I didn't really come down on one side or the other with it. It's kind of weak, I guess. But the thing that I would say about that situation that I didn't really say then, but I'll say it now about it. I mean, what had Harry Kane always said ever since he ascended to the player that we know him to be at Tottenham? He had pretty much always said the same thing, that as long as the club appeared to be moving in the right direction, he would remain with them. He was consistent in that. Think about that time when he almost went to Man City. They were coming off of the toxicity of the Mourinho era. Mm-hmm. They whiffed on all of their top choices for manager, JJ, and they settled on effing Nuno. Like, honestly, even the most ardent Tottenham supporter out there, which I'd like to think I'm in the conversation, but I'm sure there's guys who live in North London who've had season tickets their whole life. I mean, really, if you ask those people, come on, guys. Like, if Kane had always said, as long as we're moving in the right direction, I'll stay with the club. Look at the situation that Tottenham were in that moment. Are you really going to tell me that that you could sit there with a straight face and say that they were going in the right direction, that that the trajectory was upward? No, definitively not.
No.
Now, who could have seen what wound up happening where Nuno lasts a couple months, gets fired, and Conte comes in and seemingly rights the ship, although you could look at them now and say, even that, I'm not so sure. But, like, It shouldn't be that hard for us to look at the situation that they were in and say, well, if that's what Kane has always said, it's not crazy to think he'd want to leave. Now, you didn't like the way he went about it, but it's never a clean break in a situation like that, especially for a guy who came up through the academy, who's a lifelong Tottenham player. If he was going to leave, it was always going to be ugly. It was the only way it could happen. So even that, like I said, if you listen to those podcasts, I wasn't that hard on him because I always kind of felt that way about that whole situation. So even that, I don't really hold that against him. Look, I've got a lot of Tottenham players that I love, Lennon, Moussa Dembele, guys who I've talked about, but it's him. like, if you ask Tottenham fans of this era, who's your guy? It's him. It's the way, like, he just passed Jimmy Greaves. Tottenham guys who are my age, their grandparents, that's what Jimmy, they'll talk about Jimmy Greaves the way we'll talk about Kane in 30, 40 years. This is, it's amazing to see what this guy has done. And it's just so fun the way that it's happened. It wasn't a big money move from some guy who came from La Liga or Borussia Dortmund or something like that. It's a guy who's one of their own, as the song goes. So really cool. Really cool. And a great win for Tottenham as well.
Yeah, fantastic. I'll just break down Kane's Spurs goals by competition. Champions League 21, UEFA Europa League 18, Europa Conference League 6, Premier League 200. FA Cup 15, League Cup 7, 2-6-7. My question to you now is, we're hearing a lot about how Bayern Munich will come in the summer and look to take him there and will offer him the chance to maybe do something in the Champions League or certainly win a Bundesliga title. That was one of the clubs that the papers were reporting. Alan Shearer has 260 goals. I can't see how Kane will want to leave now without trying to get a crack at that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I guess you have to ask yourself, like, what, from a legacy perspective, what carries more weight? Becoming, like, staying. Tottenham have said that they're not selling him to a Premier League rival. So if they're to be trusted in that, then there's really no club he can go to in England. So if you've heard the rumors about Bayern, I mean, is winning a Bundesliga at Bayern Munich better for his legacy than becoming the Premier League's all-time leading goal scorer?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
And I honestly think if you look at Alan Shearer, say he never won that Premier League with Blackburn Rovers, but he still got 260. Would we think any differently of him? I mean, he spent how many years at Newcastle, won nothing. I don't think
he's probably, I mean, he's probably remembered more for being the Premier League's all-time leading goal scorer than he is that title at Blackburn. I mean,
1,000%.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Look, I understand Kane's desire to want to hoist a trophy. Like, he's befitting of the honor. Like, he should. There should be an image of him out there holding a trophy up. And I'm sure it kills him that he hasn't done it. That's a tough one. I don't know. That's a tough one.
Yeah,
I don't know. We'll see. In terms of the game itself, yeah, I mean, look, Kane steals the headlines. But boy, I'll tell you what, that goal that they scored, it felt very Pochettino in the way that it came about. That kind of high pressing, winning the ball back in a dangerous area. Højbjerg did a great job of playing it to Kane, who finished in Kane-like fashion. But Tottenham, it's a weird thing. I don't know how you explain this. Manchester City have owned this era, along with Liverpool, but City have won all these titles and they can't win in that building. Five times they've played there, five times they've lost. They haven't scored yet.
I think
very strange.
I think City are in a general malaise right now. They're not what they were. They're trying to find a kind of a new way forward. Then there's the stuff with Cancelo leaving, which, like, if you do believe in, like, the chemistry and bond of a group, when someone like that who's been that important as a player leaves, that can upset things. And look, they haven't been quite themselves this season. De Bruyne starting on the bench.
Yeah, that would, I know there's a lot of talk about Haaland. He didn't play well, didn't have a shot. I don't know if he even had a touch in the box. And, like, sure, but De Bruyne is the engine that makes this all go. He's the one who is going to be reliant upon setting up Haaland with his opportunities. Him coming off the bench, his uneven World Cup, just his advance. He's just getting older. There's so much mileage there. Like, we've spent so much time, JJ, talking about Liverpool, how they played 60 games last year. Maybe it's natural that there would be a setback this season. We don't usually say those things about Manchester City because we become desensitized to the fact that they're robots. They're not real people. And they just, like, continue to operate at this high of a level no matter what. But that's maybe not reality. And maybe we just need to recalibrate what a Manchester City setback season looks like. With Liverpool, it's falling to ninth. With City, maybe it's this. They're not bad. They're still second. They're still challenging for a title, but we're so accustomed to them just, putting up 90 plus points. Maybe a setback for them is something in the low 80s, finishing second.
I know it leads us into our next item, but boy, boy, did Tottenham do the Arsenal a favor.
That's right, JJ. We now know one thing that's not in Mikel Arteta's arsenal: defeating Sean Dyche next at 10. Yeah, so what's to be made of this? Is this some sort of immediate signal of what I talked about last week, that the guy who should really be worried right now is Frank Lampard, that Everton are not as bad as maybe we thought they were?
That's kind of instant coaching. I mean, we made fun last week about the bleep test and doing that kind of preseason work in the middle of the season. I mean, Everton never, under Frank Lampard, looked as even in their defeats of Chelsea and Manchester United, which were crucial at the end of last season, they never looked as energetic as this. They stopped Arsenal from playing in such, they were so tight, compact. So, you know, the coach's voice YouTube, where coaches like Guardiola, Mourinho come in and talk about their greatest wins, and they show how they, with these little coins, they show how they set up their team for these victories. Like, so Dyche did one for when they beat Burnley, or when Burnley beat Liverpool. And a lot of what he did in that game, he did and operated against Arsenal, the kind of V defensive formation in terms of pressing, and the way they closed down Arsenal players, and they created the better chances. They never let Arsenal settle into a rhythm. It's the most discombobulated Arsenal have looked at any point this season. I mean, I know they lost at Old Trafford, but the truth of that game was that they could easily have won that match as well. You know, that was a much closer game. This was like concerning. And the one thing for Arteta and Arsenal now is to make sure that doesn't happen again, in the sense that whatever Dyche did, they have to be able to play through that now, because there'll be other teams looking at that and thinking, give that a go.
Yeah, I would say that is a little bit worrisome for Arsenal. That's now back-to-back games being shut out. This one from Everton, previously FA Cup against Manchester City. Maybe it's natural that they would hit some sort of mid-season bump in the road. It had all been going so swimmingly for them.
Yeah, I mean, and ultimately it doesn't cost them because of what happened at White Hart Lane. But can I just circle back again what Dyche did? Like, I saw things there in that game that I hadn't really seen in a while. See, Seamus Coleman on the overlap, whipping in a cross for Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who flashes a header just wide. A goal off a set piece where Tarkowski physically bullies Odegaard, just pulls him off and just nods home. They were generally just like, to quote Jamie Carragher, who often talks about Everton as, you know, Everton teams, the dogs of war, you know, tough, uncompromising, direct, all those things. And it's such a cliche, but, you know, he got that place, that building, absolutely rocking. It's as loud as it's been at any point, probably since the end of last season, and loud in the good way. It was just, there was something about Everton DNA in that game. It just smelled of Everton. Like, them at their most simplistic best. And that's a cracking result, an absolutely brilliant result.
Well, we'll see what it means if they're able to crack on and continue with the momentum of that. I'm someone who's a little bit skeptical of momentum in this
too.
League. I sometimes feel like sometimes every game is a season. I don't know if there's a link from one game to the next. Get carried away, but that doesn't even really matter, because when you're battling just for this, you just got to be the best bad team. So 3 points against Arsenal at the end of the season, that's massive.
But they're going into the derby now on Monday, and who's going in better shape, Liverpool or Everton?
I would rather be Liverpool. I'd rather be Liverpool.
Yeah, I'm just, yeah. Well, we'll see. This will be a very good test of whether what they did against Arsenal is sustainable across a few games.
So it was a very weird juxtaposition when you get these games like the one Everton just had, where a huge protest march takes place outside of the ground.
Yeah.
Planes are flying overhead saying that it's the worst run club in England. But then, like, there's that juxtaposed with the outpouring of joy moments later when they score, it's just like, I don't know. I always feel like that just looks weird to me. Are we loving this or are we hating this? Is it just all the emotions at once?
I think the fans are well able to kind of parse and separate board level, running of club, results on field. Mm-hmm. Like they're capable. Because I remember even when Rafa was beloved at Liverpool, I remember protests outside the ground. I was at a game where they sang against the Gillette and Hicks owners, even though things weren't like Liverpool were competitive in Europe, competitive in the Premier League, but they still hated the owners. So that's how it works.
Yeah, that makes sense. I understand why Everton fans feel the way they feel. It just, I don't know, it's just like a funny look to me when like...
What's the duality of man? It's the duality of the football fan. I'm really angry about this thing. The ball's gone on the net.
Yeah, it's just interesting. Yeah. Let's see. All right, JJ, our final story tonight at 10. Tonight's look at a club in crisis, Liverpool.
Oy.
The club we just mentioned moments ago.
Jeez, Andrew.
Everything that was going on there was obviously concerning. Something was wrong. We had come to terms with the fact that this Liverpool season was whatever mounting challenge we were waiting for. I think we've all come to understand by now, it ain't happening. This is just not going to be that season. But I did not see 3-0 to Wolves in the cards.
No. It's about as bad a start as I've seen to a Liverpool game in, I can't remember when. And a lot of people were talking about, well, remember against Aston Villa during COVID and the 7-2. But I'm like, that just felt like a complete aberration. Like, it did not feel like this Liverpool team had fallen off the earth. This felt like a low point, and in a season of low points, and we're not even sure if the low point, if this is the low point, if there's another level to this cavern that Liverpool have fallen into. I went to, it was absolutely freezing cold day on Saturday. Friday and Saturday were minus, I'm doing it in Celsius now, but minus 11, minus 13, bitter. But I went to the Monroe for the game, the Liverpool Supporters Bar in Brooklyn. And there was, considering the weather, there was a healthy crowd in there, but it was shocking, Andrew. Absolutely terrible. You have to go back maybe to the Roy Hodgson era, or maybe the end of the Brendan Rodgers era for like a flat feeling like this. And look, everything that the manager tries to do, the midfield formations, like everything is going wrong. Like Matip just melting down in that first half, for the goals were pathetic. I would say this, Wolves are a much better side under Julian Lopetegui than they've been in the last 18 months. That, all that factored in, Liverpool should be putting up a much better performance. There was nothing good. Everything was wrong. And then when they had the 20-25 minutes of dominance in the second half, where you thought there's a goal coming here, maybe two, you had whiff chances from Salah, you had Darwin Nunez blasting straight at the keeper. You knew he wasn't going to score. Cody Gakpo, the equivalent of football mist, you know, a fog, just not making no impact. And then Wolves break and go straight down the field and score. I mean, it's not that there's like sectors of the team, you know, it's not like that center back crisis we had in 2021. Remember, where we just barely made fourth after like losing six home games in a row. It's right. Not like that. It's more like there's problems everywhere. Like we can't do anything. There was one passage of play where ball goes into midfield. I think it's Bacicic gets it, plays it out to Robertson. There's nothing on. Robertson comes back inside to Thiago. Thiago gives the ball away, and then whoop, Wolves are straight down the field on the attack. And it just seemed to happen over and over again. And Liverpool just look, they look done.
Like, yeah, they done do. They look defeated. Yeah. You know, they've, every season they've been so invested. I mean, last year, JJ, they thought they were competing for a quadruple last season for most of the year. So they've been, they were so invested in in every front. So it must be jarring for them to have a season like this that almost feels, I mean, I won't say meaningless. They have to believe that they can still make a push for fourth, but you know, obviously they're still alive in the Champions League. So once that kicks back in, who knows? That can couple of matches there, and it can rejuvenate a lot of things, maybe potentially for them. But it's got to be jarring in terms of the season itself for the games to be feeling like this for them, where they're not playing for anything.
No, it's terrible. And I was in the bar with a couple of people who were over from Norway, and Lars, one of the guys, was just like this big Liverpool supporter, and he said to me afterwards, and I can't pronounce the word, so I won't try, but he said there's a word in Norwegian for this, which just basically means this doesn't matter. And I know what he meant by when he was saying this doesn't matter is that he's just so numb to it now, that there's an acceptance, this is the season, this is what's going to be. But like, it does matter. Like, if that, us not being able to make a run at the Champions League, like, that is money we can't afford not to have coming into the club. You have to be in the Champions League. It's just a disaster, an absolute disaster this season. You're hoping that, you know, when are you going to see Jota? When are you going to see Diaz? Something that can reinvigorate the side.
Is Gakpo going to really start to kick on? Nunez, you know, when are we going to start to see, you know, his chances created are brilliant, but when will you see the finished product?
Right.
Will Mo Salah just think this new contract, the most lucrative contract in the Premier League, is have we seen the best of him? Is that money? He might still be a good player, but is he ever going to sniff the heights that he was at previously?
But he looks discombobulated by the changes that have been made around him. And like, if you look at the profile, Andrew, of a Liverpool forward, Diaz, Jota, Salah, Mane, Firmino, Minamino, even Origi, like, does Gakpo or Nunez even come close to any of those?
Well, they might. We don't know yet.
We don't, but there feels like there's those two signings we're led to believe now were not made by the, you know, the guys who were involved in that area. These were Klopp signings.
Right.
Where, like, the sporting director's gone. The stats and analytics guy is gone. Like, the club seems to be in this, like, drift. And I don't... I mean, it happened over a period of time. I think only buying one midfielder since 2018 in Naby, having Naby Keita come in, who didn't fail. There's something in this about letting things slide, relying on Fabinho being good, relying on Henderson being good, relying on the fitness of Thiago, just letting these things slide, letting these happen, not replenishing, not refreshing, and that's how you end up in the situation you are in right now.
Can I surprise you for a sec? Because you know I...
Absolutely. You're always a surprise to me, Andy.
Because I often affectionately refer to Jurgen Klopp as the moaner in chief. And so yes. he did another one of his moans this weekend when he... So Wolves win 3-0, but Klopp in his press conference says, well, I don't count the third goal because that was their first time in our half, in our half of the field in the entire second half. So the third goal doesn't count. And it's expert level moaning. But I couldn't criticize it because I heard him say that, and my initial reaction, JJ, was, "Hey, I do that," like, because we had just talked about the U.S.'s recent friendly, how like I'll play those games in my head of like on a near goal scoring chance or something like that. I create my own scoreline. If they miss like an obvious chance, I'll say, "Oh well, in a game that matters, we would have scored that, so that counts." Klopp does the same thing, and I think it's great. The mind, you can manipulate the game however you want to do it in your mind. It's fantastic. I love that him and I are cut from a similar cloth in that way.
I didn't think that was the direction you were going to go in terms of press conferences. I thought his behavior towards James Pearce of The Athletic was disgraceful.
He's the poster boy for sore loserdom.
Sure, and he knows it. But like, this was really frustrating because I don't know what James Pearce wrote in The Athletic that upset him so much that he wouldn't take the question. So he for anyone who didn't see it, James Pearce asked a question about the bad starts and conceding early. Klopp goes, I don't like to answer this question. I don't want to answer a question from you because you know why, the things you've written. So I don't want to answer this question if someone else can ask it. And Paul Roan of the Sunday Times goes, I'll ask it. And he asks the same question and Klopp answers to him.
What a ridiculousness.
It's bad. And it like feeds into the whole idea that things, you know, things are in a bad, bad shape, even though we've seen many examples in the past of Klopp being testy when the team hasn't won. But I listened to Rafa Honigstein on the Athletic Football Podcast, and he said there is a lot of similarities with Klopp's behavior with journalists at the same point when things were falling apart in his final season with Borussia Dortmund. Hmm. And the thing Rafa Honigstein, and the point that he made was, he will take a question about, well, that decision didn't go your way, or that was a mistake, or whatever. You know, the individual little things in a game, if it goes wrong, he's fine. But if you question the overall health or system or feeling in the club, he hates that. And he reacts very, very aggressively towards that, because he does not, this is what Raf said, he does not want that mentality that things are wrong at the club seeping through to his players, because that's, if there's any doubt, because of the things Klopp asks his players to do, the running, the pressing, if there's any doubt in their minds about what they're being told, whether they've read it or heard it somewhere else, that affects performance, that affects what he's trying to do. And so that's why he acts so aggressively. There's no excuse for that way he treated James Pearce, in my opinion, unless there's something horrendous that James Pearce has done. And if so, I want to hear it. But
yeah, I'm curious too.
But that's Rafa Honigstein on the Athletics podcast. That was his view on why Klopp acts so aggressively. But Andrew, Derby on Monday now. Jeez, all of a sudden that is
huge.
So fraught. They have to get a win. And then there's a lot of people who are like, well, we don't want to win and get halfway and then end up in the Europa League. So, and I get that too.
Nah, really?
Well, there's a train of thought, and maybe it's just my Liverpool supporting friends, but one of them said, if we're not going to make anything for a season, let's have just domestic football. Let's not have conference or whatever the hell, and try and rebuild with just domestic football to focus on.
I guess I get it. Liverpool have won a Champions League recently. They've been to a couple finals. So I suppose I approach it differently. Look, the Europa League's not the competition that I want to be in, obviously, but I don't see it as the burden that some others see it as. It's a competition that if my team is in it, I want to win that thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. Liverpool have Everton coming up on Monday, then Newcastle, then Real Madrid, then Crystal Palace, then Manchester United. Those are four. I don't want to, nothing against Crystal Palace. I know they're ahead of Everton in the table, but those feel like four really tricky fixtures in their next five games. It's tough. This is a really, Klopp has not been through many stretches like this. This is about as tough as it's been for him right now. We'll see how they handle it.
Yeah.
That about wraps up the news at 10, JJ. I do have a couple other quick things that I feel like do need to be mentioned. I guess this is kind of our sports and weather now portion of the news. But wanted to mention, Fulham's performance against Chelsea. I know that feels a long time ago now because it was last Friday, but it was technically this match week. I mean, you know, a lot's been made of, oh, Chelsea spent all that money to draw 0-0 with Fulham. Ha, 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 ha. Fulham were excellent. I mean, defensively, that performance from Fulham was spectacular, I thought. Tim Ream, I saw he made Alan Shearer's team of the week. This is, he saved a goal from, you know, incredible hustle back to kind of pull one off the line for Chelsea that looked like it was going to be a sure thing. He was unbelievable in this game. I don't know how many examples I can think of like this, of a guy really, really kind of finding himself in this way at this sort of age. You don't see this. It's really, I don't know, it's really unique.
Yeah, and we did a great In the Club with Jack Collins last week. You can go and watch it on YouTube on its own on Caught Offside, and go subscribe to our YouTube channel, and he goes into like kind of every aspect of Fulham, but Ream in particular, and how, I don't want to step on anything he says, go listen to it, go watch it, but Ream was kind of just putting in great performances in the Championship. Then when they get to the Premier League, he was kind of cast aside. So maybe this was in him all along. And but it's rare. It's rare you can kind of pull out those performances at that. I was going to say advanced age. He's like five years younger than me.
But I mean, in a sporting sense. And then one other thing I wanted to mention too, for Manchester United, sort of a best of times, worst of times game. They do win 2-1, and boy, if you sort of want to see, okay, what is Ten Hag football look like? Their second goal was just a thing of absolute beauty. Quick passing, set up for Rashford to just tap one in front. It was a gorgeous goal. And I guess if he can bottle up whatever he wants his style and his brand to be, I would think that goal would be it. Cause it was just gorgeous. Now, I also want to say, because there's been a lot of controversy over Casemiro's straight red that he received.
Right.
United fans can come at me. I can be soft. You can say whatever you want. It's a red. Like, I don't get it. He put both of his hands around another player's neck. And you can say to me all you want, oh, no, but he's trying to defuse the situation. It's not an aggressive act. Yes, it is. Okay, if you put two hands around someone's neck, yeah, in this situation, it was diffused, because I forget who it was, the player that he did that to, decided not to take it up a notch. But like, you do that same thing to another guy, and now you got another fight going on because Casemiro just tried to choke someone. Yeah. So like, yeah, in this situation, it looked like it was diffused, not because of Casemiro's actions, just because the guy he did it to decided not to go crazy, but somebody else might have. It's a red. It just is.
Former Premier League ref Dermot Gallagher was on Sky, and this is Dermot's succinct comment. I think Casemiro is a red card. The reason I say that is because you can't condone a player putting both hands around somebody's throat.
Yeah, like I've just seen so much pushback from United supporters to the idea that this was a red, and I don't know. I don't get it. It just is.
What would you do if I put my hands around your throat?
If you put both, I'd go crazy.
Yeah.
I wouldn't just take it. I'd go nuts. No. Casemiro's lucky that didn't happen here. Then it would have been a way more obvious red. So I don't know. Apparently that was a big controversy, but to me, I don't know. I'm soft, JJ. It is what it is.
This is a very weird weather section.
Is this not?
Yeah, there's warm air moving in from the Midwest, just in and around the area of Casemiro's hands, which will be on someone's throat.
Yeah, well, there you have it. I don't have too much more. I did want to say one thing on a far more serious note.
Yes.
What has happened in Turkey over the last 24 hours is horrifying. The earthquake followed by the aftershock, which I think the aftershock was a 7.7. The pictures that we're seeing from there are, it's just unbelievable. I mean, war zone, call it whatever you want. It's a true disaster. And at the time of recording, I've seen all kinds of different reports, but Christian Atsu, who's playing in Turkey, who only just over the weekend scored in the 97th minute to win for the club that he's playing with. JJ, I don't know about you. I've seen a lot of different reports over the course of the day, but the media outlets that I trust most, ESPN FC, I think Sky, BBC, I think they're all saying that at this point, he is still listed as missing.
Colin Miller of the, he's the European football on the Daily Mirror. He tweeted this at 2:30 today. Christian Atsu has been found alive inside rubble after today's devastating earthquake that rocked Turkey and neighboring nations. He reportedly has breathing difficulties and an injury to his right foot and has been transported to hospital.
So I saw that report as well. I'm not saying he's not reliable. No. I hope that report is accurate. I hope it's substantiated. I know, you know, ESPN FC here in the US is one of the sites that I just kind of use as sort of my guide as to what I'm comfortable going with. And at this point, they're still
okay.
Their article here says Hete Spor's Christian Atsu, sporting director, also missing after Turkey earthquake. Hopefully by the time you're all listening to this, that report is substantiated and he has been found, that they have been found. I've seen different varying reports over the course of the day. But all I can say is it's horrible. Christian Atsu, formerly of Chelsea, Newcastle, Ghana International. So are, you know, obviously we're not just for him and that, and those of that club, who have been affected by this, but everyone there, because it's really, really horrible to see. So we'll be thinking all the best thoughts that we can possibly think to hope that that those guys wind up being okay. And yep. I mean, just, but you see some of the figures of the toll, the death toll that this has taken, and it's really horrifying.
It's truly appalling, and our thoughts and our support and our best wishes are with everyone out there. It's just awful.
Yeah. That about does it here on this edition of Caught Offside. We should say before we get out that the meeting that we were hoping for, JJ, of the Seattle Sounders against Real Madrid, it's not going to happen. The Sounders fell to Al Ahly.
They left 1-0. That one on the table, Andrew. They were by far the most dominant team in the first half. In the second half, they allowed Al Ahly to get into it a little bit more. Al Ahly started moving the ball much better around the box. It was a fluky, deflected goal in past Stefan Fry. And really, regardless of what you think of the tournament, or I think of the tournament, lots of nations regard this as a good tournament. And an important tournament, one they want to win. It would have been big for them to play Real Madrid. That hasn't happened. And I think there'll be a few execs up and down the league who will be maybe not garment rending, but certainly a bit upset that this one didn't come to pass.
Yeah. Yep. So there you have it, my friend. I don't have much else. You?
No, that's it. I'm done with the 10 o'clock news.
All right. That was a long, the 10 o'clock news has branched almost to midnight. Is that normal, JJ? Does the British news, is it of such a caliber that it lasts almost an hour and a half?
If my father could have found a midnight news, he would have watched that too.
Well, I enjoyed this edition of the 10 o'clock news. Hey, good stuff, my friend. To you, I say...
Check you later, phone boy.
I'll see you.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.